All right. Good evening, everyone. Let's begin. So we're continuing tonight in Parshas. I think we have a shortage of source sheets. So if you are sitting next to someone who even you mildly like, and you could share, that might be helpful as people come in. Okay. So what I want to draw your attention to, when it comes to Parshas Vayira, there are so many incredibly dramatic episodes. There's the episode, of course, of Avraham Avinu recovering in the aftermath of the Bris Milah, yet still being fully steeped in the Chesed of Hachnasas Archim, running after the guests. The three strange men who just happened to show up in the middle of the desert. The Parsha, of course, ends with the dramatic episode of the Akedah. Chodesh Baruch Hu calling upon Avraham Avinu to do what, according to most opinions, is the 10th and final test. Take your son, your only son, take Yitzchak, and offer him up as a carbon. So we're not going to deal with either of those tonight. Instead, what I'm going to do is draw your attention to an episode that occurs in the middle of the parasha that I happen to think is incredibly and overwhelmingly dramatic. Yet very often, it goes unnoticed. There are source sheets right over here on the table when you walk in, if anyone needs. Let's take a look. Number one. Vahikot siyam osam achutza. So remember, again, a little bit of background. After the Malachim leave Avraham Avinu, they go ahead and they go to Sdom. The purpose of going to Sdom ultimately is to go ahead and destroy the cities, but in the process, of course, also save Lot and his family. The whole story of Lot, and Lot being willing to offer up his daughters in an effort to go ahead and save the guests, is a strange story in and of itself. But what I want to draw your attention to is the end of the story. The Malachim finally convince Lot, his wife, and some of the children to take leave of Sdom. So the pasuk says, number one, Vahikot siyam osam achutza. When they took Lot and his wife and his daughters out of the home, Vayomer, the Malach says to Lot, Himaleit al nafshecha, run away, run for your life. Al tabit acharecha, do not look back. Va'al ta'amo, do not stand still. Bechalakikar, in the entire plain. Why hahara himaleit, run to the mountains, pentisapeh, lest you perish. Number two, Vashem himtirastom, so a couple of psukim later, Chodesh Baruch Hu brings down the destructive rains, the fire on Sdom, Gafris va'ish me'is Hashem in Hashamayim, Vayafoch es ha'arim ha'el, ves kol ha'kikar, ves kol yoshvei ha'aretz, yoshvei ha'arim, v'tzamach ha'adama. So Chodesh Baruch Hu brings the, as the pasuk says, the brimstone, the fire, destroys the cities. Lot and his family are running away. What happens? Vatabet ishto me'acharav, vatehi nitziv melach. Mrs. Lot, Lot's wife, we'll learn her name in just a little bit, looks back, and she turns into a pillar of salt. So what I'd like to focus on tonight are two basic questions. One from number one, one from number two. Question number one is, why is there a prohibition for Lot and his family to look back? Why are they not permitted to go ahead and look back upon the destruction of Sodom and Amora? Himaleit al nafshecha, al tabit acharecha. Do not look back. So question number one, why not? Question number two is, Lot's wife looks back, clearly in violation of the directive of the angels, and she turns into a pillar of salt. Why a pillar of salt? So these are the two fundamental questions we're going to grapple with tonight. So perhaps the most straightforward response, Rashi, or most straightforward approach to this, Rashi number three. Rashi says, "Al tabit acharecha, do not look back. Why not? Atoyer shate imohem, ubischos Avram atonitzol, eincho kidai liros beparanusam va'atonitzol." So according to Rashi, there's a very simple cheshbon, very simple calculation here, which is, why is Lot saved from Sdom? Why is he saved from Sdom? In the merit of Avraham Avinu. He is not saved because of his own personal piety or righteousness. He's saved because he has a chashiva uncle. Right? He has a very important uncle. One of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's favorite members of all humanity. Avraham Avinu. He's saved in the merit of Avraham. So according to Rashi, the Malachim are saying to Lot, you have no right to look back. Because in reality, you should be destroyed amongst the rest of the residents of Sdom. You're just as wicked, you're just as corrupt, you're just as evil, you're just as terrible. And again, remember, we don't know all that much about Lot. But we certainly learn a lot about Lot in the episode that immediately follows this. What's the next episode? Right, Lot impregnates his daughters. an accident happens once, right? An accident. Meaning, and again, Chazal see this, Lot allows himself to become drunk, inebriated. You know, when Chazal speak about the dangers of drunkenness, do you know what they call it when you get so drunk that you don't know the difference between right and wrong? You know what Chazal call that? Lot drunk. Shechruso shalot is when you get so drunk that the boundaries between just basic right and wrong are blurred. That tells us a lot about Lot and a lot about his family. So according to Rashi, he really did not deserve to be saved. But why? He was saved because of Avraham Avinu. So because of that, the ability to look upon the wicked as they are being destroyed, who has the right to look at the wicked as they're being destroyed? Only the righteous. Lot, you're not righteous, you're not being saved of your own merit, and therefore you have no right to look back. I'll tell you something very interesting. We've seen this motif a little bit earlier. If you take a look at number 4, so the Pasuk in Parshas Noach says, Tzohar ta'asela teva. You shall make a tzohar for the teva, for the ark. And Rashi records two opinions. Yesh omrim chalon, v'yesh omrim even tova mi'irlem. One says it was a window, others say it was a luminescent stone. According to the opinion who says that it was a luminescent stone, why wasn't it a window? Well, according to that approach, because Noach did not have the right to look upon the destruction of the rest of humanity. Noach, you're only saved because you're the most righteous person of the generation. You're a comparative tzaddik. You're a relative tzaddik. But you don't have the right to look upon the destruction of the rest of humanity. Along those same lines, Lot, don't look back. You have no right to go ahead and look at the destruction of your fellow countrymen as they are being punished for their sins. You should have been punished as well, but you're spared because of Avraham Avinu. So according to this approach, so why does the wife of Lot go ahead and turn into a pillar of stone? So remember again, as we just said, look at number 7. As she stood still, she was overtaken by the form of death, which was following close behind them. So according to Rashi, there's nothing special in her turning into a pillar of salt, except that remember, what's raining down upon the earth? Brimstone, fire, sulfur. So again, she essentially, when it says she turned into a pillar of salt, what it just means is that what was happening to the rest of stone happened to her as well. Nothing specifically unique about her punishment, nothing specifically tied to her personality, her deeds or her misdeeds, but rather again, because she stopped, she looked back, she suffered the same fate as the residents of stone. But take a look at number 7. Rashi brings down another approach. And here Rashi says, "Vatihi nitziv melach," and this perhaps is the most well-known approach. Rashi quotes the Medrash. The Medrash says, "B'melach chata, u'b'melach laksa." Eshes Lot, the wife of Lot, who again, you know, the Medrash tells us her name. Her name was Iris, Ayin Yud Resh Yud Saf Iris. So she sinned with salt, and therefore again she was punished with salt. How did she sin with salt? Amar La, Lot says to his wife, Tini ma'at melach l'orchem alalus, going back a little bit, Lot invites the guests into his home. He doesn't know they're malachim. He thinks they're regular people. He invites them into his home, and he offers them what? Ugos matzos. He offers them some matzah, some loaves of bread, and salt. So he asks his wife, honey, can I trouble you for some salt for the guests? And what does she respond? Amar La, It's bad enough that you invited company into our home, but now you want to go in and give them salt also? So the Medrash in number 9 expands on this a little bit. The Medrash has Shvati Nitziv Melach, Lefi Shechata B'Melach. So the Medrash has a little bit of a different account. The Medrash writes, Lefi Shechata B'Melach, the wife of Lot sinned with salt. Ketzod, that night when the angelic guests came to the home of Lot, so Iris, the wife of Lot, went over to one of her neighbors to borrow some salt, to borrow a cup of salt. So this is interesting. What a neighbor. What do you need, like a yenta? Tell me, what do you need salt for? Right? What are you using the salt for? So listen to this. So apparently you can infer that Mrs. Lot must have said, Iris must have said, well, you know, I'm baking, I'm cooking, whatever it is. So what does the neighbor respond?
Yom.
You were at the supermarket today. Why didn't you pick up salt when you were shopping today? So again, but this also gives you a little bit of a window into the nature of the people of Sodom. So here again, the neighbor's challenging her. What do you need salt for? You're telling me that you're cooking? You didn't know you were going to be cooking this morning when you went out shopping? Now, how can you be so unprepared? How can you be so irresponsible? Why don't you have salt? So finally, she says, Amar lahen, ein anu tzvichim melech. So Iris finally says, you're right. I don't need any salt. Elo, sheba'u lanu archim. My husband, again, brought guests home. Ulekach yadu anshei Sodom b'malachim sheba'u veso shalot. And this is, by the way, because, you know, one of the interesting parts that comes out in the story is the people of Sodom surround Lot's house when they find out that he had company. Where did they find out that he had company? So apparently it's the Nudnik neighbor. So apparently the Nudnik neighbor was giving Iris a hard time about the salt, goes ahead and tells everyone that Lot and his wife are having guests. So again, these two midrashim really work the same. Therefore, Ashes Lot, after getting such a hard time from the neighbor, and now again, raising the ire of the people of Sodom, says to her husband, what's the matter with you? Why, it's bad enough that you brought people home. It's bad enough that you got me and the family involved in this hospitality thing, achnasas archim. That's not enough. Now you want to give them salt also? Therefore, according to Rashi, because she sinned with salt, she was punished with salt. And therefore, when she disobeys the directive of the malachim, of the angels, and she looks back, she turns into a pillar of salt. But if you look at number 10, so this is from the Aznaim Latorah, the Aznaim Latorah is Rav Sirotskin. So Rav Sirotskin asks a fascinating question. This is on the right-hand side paragraph. So he asks, V'tzarech lahavin. So clearly, what Rashi seems to be telling us is as follows, that Mrs. Lot did not like company. She did not like hospitality. Now again, this wasn't the pshat that her husband just brought people home at the wrong time. She was opposed to this idea. Remember again, Sodom was the antithesis of chesed, was the antithesis of kindness, of human kindness. This is why it was an incredible thing that Avram Avinu, who was the paradigmatic example of chesed, advocates for the people of Sodom, who were the paradigmatic antithesis of chesed. So asks Rav Sirotskin a fascinating question. Look on the right-hand side column, first line. V'tzarech lahavin. He says, I don't understand something. Madua lo rabo imo odas hamatzos. So listen to the story. He says, there's something about the story that doesn't make sense. So what happened? Lot invites the company in. Remember again, what does he feed them? What does the pasuk say? What does he feed them?
Matzos.
So Rashi understands that it's actually Pesach time. This goes back to a whole concept in Chazal that the avos, the patriarchs and matriarchs, kept the mitzvos of the Torah even before the Torah was given. But leaving all that aside, whether it's matzah or whether he gives them loaves of bread, the point is, he comes home, he says, Iris, we have company, would you mind baking some bread? Okay. So she bakes the bread, gives them the bread, and then when he asks for the salt, she goes off on him. Asks Rav Sirotskin, why didn't she get upset about the bread? If this is about her unwillingness to engage in hospitality, her unwillingness to engage in chesed, salt is nothing. She had to go into the kitchen and she had to, however you make dough, right? She had to go ahead and do all of that stuff, right? In order to go ahead, my wife is here, she takes care of that, Baruch Hashem, right? So whatever had to be done, why doesn't she give him a hard time about that? Why only about the salt? It's such an incredible question. So he says something amazing. Vihine, get ready for this. And this, by the way, I think blows the lid off this story in such a dramatically different way. Vihine Lot ra'a beiso shel Avram Avinu. If there's one thing that Lot saw in the home of Avram Avinu, shehayeh meshtadel lo rak la'achil es ha'orchem kedei svia, ach gam loses livnehem dvorim hamoshchem es ha'achila v'hamegarim es ha'te'avon. I'm just going to read a few more lines. Kedei sheyochlu v'yavriyu kimosh nasan la'orchem ha'ele gimel l'shonos b'chardol. Listen to this. If there's one thing that, what was unique about, you think Avram Avinu was the only person in the world who was a Baal Chesed? There are plenty of people who did Chesedim. Avram Avinu's Chesed was unique. In that what? In that he went ahead and he went above and beyond. He didn't just do Chesed. He did Chesed with incredible gusto. Chesed above. I'll give you, you know where this comes up? This is going to come up in next week's parasha. When Avram Avinu sends Eliezer to find a wife for Yitzchak. So what's the test that Eliezer devises? Remember again, he says, I'm going to wait by the well. I'm going to ask a girl for a drink. Give me to drink. And if she says to me, sure, you could have to drink. And please, allow me to water your camels. Do you know how much water camels drink? I don't know how much water camels drink, but it's a lot of water, right? Rivka Imenu, right? Well, she was just Rivka then, was a young girl. So what? That she has to water the flock of camels? Isn't it enough chesed if a strange man comes over to you and says, can I have a drink, that you're kind enough to give a stranger a drink? You have to water his camels also? It's like ridiculous. That's Abraham Medik Chesed. Abraham Medik Chesed is not just doing nice things for people. It's going above and beyond. It's defying expectations. Chesed means I do something nice. Being a Baal Chesed means I'm a nice, I'm a kind, I'm a charitable person. Being an Avram Avinu Baal Chesed means I go above and beyond for the other. And I even go above and beyond that which is the norm. That which is even expected. So look what the Yoznei Metorah writes. He says something amazing. I'm in the right-hand paragraph, four lines up from where it ends. V'ratzalot, kishenis oru bo rikshe tshuva chaya haruach, asher rabbe v'savram avinu. So listen to this. Says the Oznei Metorah something amazing. Lot is a conflicted personality. Lot is an neshama, an incredible inner conflict. Why? Because Lot grew up in the home of Avram Avinu. Lot knew what was right. Why did he choose to live in Sodom? He chose to live in Sodom ultimately because there were financial opportunities there. Because he made himself a nice fortune, made himself a lot of money. He rose to prominence. But he knew that his life was spiritually empty. He knew that he was void of any meaning. And so when those guests walk into Sodom, what does Lot see? What does Lot see in them? Lot sees spiritual redemption. Lot sees the ability to reclaim his identity as a nephew of Avram Avinu. Lot sees in them the ability to spiritually rehabilitate himself, lift himself up, and become a true Baal Chesed. This was not just about hospitality for Lot. This was about starting over. This was about reclaiming spirituality. This was about spiritual rejuvenation. So what does Lot do? So Lachko says at Agobaze, V'tziva al ishtolais laseis l'chol apachos, left-hand column, ma'at melach lo'orchim. So what does Lot do? He has his wife prepare the loaves, or the matzos, whatever it is. They bring it out. Why does Lot ask for salt? Was it because ultimately, again, the loaves, the matzahs weren't tasty enough? What did the salt represent to Lot? What did it represent? Going above and beyond. It represented, again, giving them matzah, inviting them into my house, giving them a place to sleep. That's chesed. That's chesed. Giving them the extra condiment, giving them the salt, giving them a little extra flavor. That's going above and beyond. Why is Lot going above and beyond? Because he's trying to reclaim the Abrahamic identity that he lost by living all of this time in stone. And so he says to his wife, can we give them a little bit of salt? The bread's wonderful. The challahs are wonderful. The matzahs are fantastic. The salt's not needed for the flavor. The salt's more needed for what it means to me spiritually. What it means to me on a holiness reclamation level. The ability to regain my spiritual standing by going above and beyond the other. So what happens? The ishto hasdomis, rabba imo va'amra. So remember, Iris was from Sodom. So she says to him, enough. Enough. Here is where I draw the line. Lididi, ain't tzarech la'aseis la'archem u'ma. Sira says, you know, if it was up to me, I wouldn't give these guys anything. I would not give them anything. Remember, kiminag Sodom. Now again, Iris is not a bad person, as we're going to see. She is not a bad woman. What is she? She's a product of her upbringing. She's a product of her surroundings. She is a child and now an adult woman of Sodom. Sodom as the antithesis of chesed. By the way, you see what a good wife she is. Why? She's willing to go along with this craziness to begin with, right? She said, okay, you know what? I don't need any of this. Fine. I'll go ahead and go along with having the company. I'll even bake them chalas. I'll even let them stay in my house. Avala filo lididoch.
Aval afilu ledidach shetarach lerachim al hareivim dai lahem beprusas lechem kidei svia.
She says, enough is enough. I am not going above and beyond. I'm not bringing the salt.
Aval chapes shufos eich ubemal ligros asate avon etzlam shiyoch liyosim ichtei svia minagro kazeh lo etein lahanhig bistom.
So this is something absolutely amazing. So what happens over here? So she draws the line. She's willing to go along with Lot, with her husband, to a certain degree. But to go above and beyond, now I have to go get salt? Now understand what's really happening over here. What is she scared of? What is she scared of? She's scared that her husband is flipping out, right? She's scared that now he's a chozer b'tshuva. What's going to happen? He's becoming like his uncle now, right? You want salt. What's next? You're going to want chayin for the gefilte fish. What's going to want? You want to tell you what's going to be this? What's going to be? I'll go along with a little bit of craziness. You know, every couple, every spouse has to go along with a little bit of craziness of the other. We each have our own respective craziness. But at a certain point in time, Eishes Lot Iris says, enough, enough. I see where this is going. You're trying to reclaim your holiness. You're trying to reclaim your Abrahamic identity. You are trying to become once again holy. Well, guess what, my dear husband? I didn't sign up for that. That's not the life we agreed to build together. That's not the home we created together. I did not sign up for this. I love you very much. But here's where I draw the line on that love. I'll give you the chalas. I'll give you the masses. I'm not giving you the salt. Because why? It's not the salt. It's never the salt. What was it? It was what the salt represented. The salt represented to Eishes Lot, to Iris, this flipping out Fafrumta husband who's going to try to once again become like his uncle, like Avram, to try to reclaim and regain his lost spirituality. And she says, no, thank you. So why is she punished? By turning into a pillar of salt. So watch this. Take a look at number 13. The Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva says as follows. Arba'a ve'esim dvarim ma'akvin es ha'tshuva. You know, as one could imagine, the Rambam's Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam's laws of repentance, are all about repentance, all about tshuva. And if there's one fundamental tenet in the laws of tshuva, the laws of repentance, is that you can always do tshuva. You can always do tshuva, no matter how badly you mess up, no matter how dramatic your mistakes in life may be, you always have the ability to turn yourself around to do tshuva. Except for the exceptions. What are the exceptions? The Rambam writes in number 13, Arba'a ve'esrim dvarim ma'akvin es ha'tshuva. There are 24 things that prevent a person from doing tshuva. I'm not going to go through 24, I'm just going through one of them. Hamata es chaveiro miderech tova l'ra'a. If you prevent someone else from self-actualizing, if you prevent someone else from growing, if you go ahead and you cause someone to go on a negative life detour, says the Rambam, there's no tshuva for that. Now, by the way, that's not a punishment, that's a consequence. See, I could do tshuva for what? For myself. I could do tshuva for myself. What the Rambam's saying is, if you prevent someone else from growing, if you derail someone else's forward or upward trajectory, if you do something that takes the wind out of someone's spiritual sails, and that person never ends up self-actualizing, I can never do tshuva for that. I can't do tshuva because I can't fix it, because I can't change it. I caused the problem, but I am powerless to fix it. And now we begin to see the dramatic story of Eishes Lot. Eishes Lot Iris had an incredible opportunity to go ahead and fulfill one of the most important tenets in marriage. What is the primary obligation of one spouse to another? It's a very important question. The primary obligation of one spouse to another is to facilitate growth. To facilitate growth. What is a happy marriage? What is a fulfilling marriage? It's not a marriage where there's tons of presents. Presents are wonderful. It's fantastic. It's not where there's nice stuff. Those are all great things. A successful, meaningful, holy marriage is where each spouse helps to facilitate the growth of the other. What is a destructive marriage? When one spouse undermines the forward momentum and the growth of the other. what happened over here in this dramatic moment of stone. Eshes Lot sees her husband trying to reclaim his spirituality. She sees him trying to reclaim his holiness. She sees him trying to rekindle that Abrahamic spark of chesed, because you know what? Lot was brought up in a good home. Lot saw Avram and Sarah. Lot saw what it meant to be the ambassador of God, and he missed it and he wanted it. And when these three men saunter into his life, he sees the opportunity for spiritual redemption. And what does his wife do in that moment? She undermines the growth. She undermines the growth. She says, no, no. The chalas I'll give you, the matzah I'll give you, but I know what that salt represents. That salt represents going above and beyond. That salt represents Abrahamic chesed. That salt represents not just being nice, but being a baal chesed like Avraham Avinu. That I will not support. That I will not facilitate. That I don't agree with. And here's the dramatically tragic piece of this story, which is, you know, sometimes people have a desire to reclaim their former footing. And if you undermine that desire for growth, very often once it's gone, it's gone. Lot never again tries to reclaim his holiness. Lot never again tries to become a descendant of Avraham Avinu. Lot never tries to experience a spiritual rejuvenation. Why? Because his wife stamped it out. Because his wife said no. She closed the door on it. She slammed the door on it. She refused to support his spiritual rejuvenation. And the truth is, for whatever the reason, he just never had the opportunity or never wanted the opportunity again. What happens as a result? When she looks back, what does she turn into? She turns into the salt. Amida keneged mida. You would not facilitate his growth. And all it required was what? Was a little bit of salt. He wasn't asking her for much. He just wanted something symbolic to show that I'm going to go above and beyond. I'm going to be better. She refused him. And because she refused him, when she is punished, she's punished ultimately again by turning into the pillar of salt. Now we'll bring in one more piece that's going to kind of tie back to this as well. Take a look at number 14. There's a very dramatic medrash. The medrash writes, so just by the way, I also want to point out that, you know, in general, whenever you see stories in Bereshis, so stories are never there for just stories' sake. Stories are there because they teach us some type of moral ethical lesson. And anything and everything you want to know about healthy and dysfunctional marriage can all be learned from Sefer Bereshis. Right? Everything. I could save you plenty of money on therapists. Just learn Chumash. Learn Chumash and you can see what works in a marriage. You can see what doesn't work in a marriage. You can see which marriages are good. And the Torah doesn't pull any punches. The Torah tells us when spouses speak to each other, when spouses don't speak to each other, where there's communication, where parents are on the same page with raising their children, different pages on raising their children. All of this unfolds in Bereshis. So in the middle of this little story over here of Lot, we see an incredible failed marriage. Why? Because one spouse wants growth, the other does not. But not only does the other not want it, you see, sometimes it's normal for spouses to want two different things, and that's okay. And there's a way to be, supportive of what your spouse wants, even if it's not what you per se want. So Eshes Lot doesn't have to sign up for Abrahamic chesed, but what she does is she pulls the rug out from under him. So once in a marriage, one spouse is not only not supportive of the other's spiritual initiatives or endeavors, but he or she actively pulls the rug out from under the other spouse, that is a marriage, that is a relationship that is doomed. And it's doomed, the doomed nature of it comes out in Eshes Lot turning into a pillar of salt. But look at 14. There's an amazing medrash. The medrash writes, Pirkei Rabbi Elazar. So listen to this. Amr Lahem. So the Malachim said to Lot, and to Lot, his wife and his daughters, Al tabitu lacharechem, shariyar deshkinos shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu, laham tira aston ba'al amora, gafris va'ish. So what happens? So the Malach tells Lot and his family, do not look back. Do not look back. Now, there's one piece that's been missing from this entire narrative up until now, which is what? So what do we know? Malach tells them, don't look back. Then what happens? Iris looks back. What's missing? Why did she look back? Why did she look back? What was she looking for? What was she looking at? So the Medrash says something amazing. Second line, number 14. Iris, ishto shalot, nichmeru rachma al binosa nesuos, vihibit la'achareha liros, im holchos achareha im lo. There's differing accounts, but it appears that Lot had four daughters. Two of them were married, two of them were unmarried. The unmarried girls came with Lot and his wife as they fled Sodom. The married girls remained in Sodom. Iris is a mother. Iris is a mother. And so as she's fleeing Sodom, she goes in and she looks at, why does she look back? Because who is she looking for? She's holding out hope that maybe her married children have gained their senses and are running after them. What she hopes to see when she looks back are her married children. Now again, I don't know if they were married with children, without children. I don't know their family situations. But one thing is clear, which is Iris, when she has to flee with her husband and her two daughters, is leaving two of her children behind. Leaving two of her children behind. Because remember, again, the Psukim tell us that the sons-in-law, Lot's sons-in-law, thought he was crazy. They just thought he was off his rocker. They just didn't believe anything he was saying. They thought he was crazy, so they ignored him. Now that the fire and brimstone is coming down, Iris turns back with the hope, the last glimmer of hope, that maybe the married girls are running after them, following them out of Sodom. So what happens? Here the Medrash explains that it was HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself who came down to destroy Sodom. She looks back, whatever this means, she sees some element of the Shekhinah, of the Divine Presence, and she turns into a pillar of salt. So here the Medrash gives her the first time a little bit of an insight as to why Iris is turning back around. She's looking for her married daughters. Now hold on to that for just a moment. Look at number 15. There's an amazing Gemara in Meseches Yuma. The Gemara is actually a very strange Gemara. Hirhure Avera, Kashu Me Avera. So literally, Hirhure Avera means thoughts. Sinful thoughts are more difficult. Kasha literally means more difficult or more detrimental than the Avera itself. Visimanech, and the Gemara says, what's the way, how can I show this to you? Recha de Bisra is the scent of meat. What does this mean? Take a look at Rashi. Rashi number 16 says, Hirure Avera, Tavas Noshim. So Rashi in the sense is actually talking about immorality. Immoral thoughts, lustful or desirous thoughts, Kashim Lahachish Es Besaro, Yoser Migufo Shal Naisa. If a person is consumed by illicit thoughts, immoral thoughts, that could take a greater toll on a person than the commission of the actual act. Now, we're not talking about liability here, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not hold us liable for negative, impure, or wrongful thoughts. Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does hold us accountable for what we think. He holds us accountable for what we do. So we're not talking about on a liability or on a punishment level. The Gemara seems to be referring to over here on a holistic level, that if a person is consumed by lustful, desirous, immoral thoughts, sometimes being consumed by those thoughts has a greater detrimental impact on the person than the actual commission of the Avera itself. So the Gemara gives the what's the simen, what's the proof to this? Recha de Bisra. She says, Hamariach Basar Tzli, Kashalo Reach Ma'od, Shemis Avalo. That what happens sometimes if you smell meat that is cooking and it smells delicious. So that smell has the ability to awaken within you a desire for something. And that desire sometimes is even stronger than what? Even if it's sitting on your plate itself. So the Hirhure Avera, Kasha Me Avera. Which again, this Gemara is a sheer unto itself about Judaism's Mahalech approach in terms of purity of thought, what that means, how we accomplish that, but I want to show you something very different. Look at the Chazon Ish number 18. The Chazon Ish writes as follows. Hirhure Avera Kashim Avera. So first of all, understand the verbiage is difficult to understand. Avera, thoughts about the Avera are more difficult than the Avera itself. Which, again, sounds a bit counterintuitive. If we're not held accountable for thoughts, then how can you tell me that thoughts about an Avera, about committing an Avera, are even worse than the commission of the Avera itself? So the Chazon Ish advances such an incredible interpretation. Get ready for this. Koi al hirhurim shal acher ha'avera. The Chazon Ish says you're reading the Gemara wrong. Hirhure Avera does not mean illicit thoughts. It does not mean desirous thoughts. It does not mean sinful thoughts. What does hirhure avera mean? It means people who obsessively think about their sins after they have committed them. Hirhure avera. If I can't get over the fact that I made terrible mistakes, if I can't stop thinking about my missteps and my mistakes, if I can't stop thinking about my failures, lachshov machshavos yeyush v'domein. You see, you know what happens? We all fail. We all fail. And sometimes what the Gemara is telling us is, hirurei avera, in the aftermath of failure, I become all consumed with my failure. I can't believe I did this. I can't believe I behaved this way. I can't believe I was so weak. I can't believe I fell prey to temptation. I can't believe I engaged in this negative behavior. And what happens? A person obsesses it over enough that it creates a sense of yeush. It creates a sense of despair that a person begins to think of themselves not as someone who has committed a sin, but rather how? A sinner. There's a difference between someone who commits a sin and a sinner. What's the difference? I'll give you the difference. It's the same way that when disciplining your child, you never say to your child, you're a bad child. Chas v'shalom. A parent should never, ever, ever utter those words. There is no such thing as a bad child. There are good children who do bad things. There are good children who make serious mistakes. But you never call a child a bad child. Why? Because a bad child is a label. A bad child is an identity. Instead, what I say to my child is, you're a beautiful child. You're wonderful. You did something really bad and we need to figure out ultimately how to deal with this. But at your core, you're good. There are good people. So I'm not a sinner. I'm just a good person who commits bad things sometimes. And there's a big distinction that's not semantics. To call myself a sinner means that's my identity. That's my identity. I'm a sinner. No. I'm not a sinner. At my core, I believe myself to be a good person, but yet sometimes I make really bad decisions. Sometimes I do really bad stuff. So says the Chazon Ish something amazing. If a person in the aftermath of sin obsesses over their mistakes, can't let go of their mistakes, then what ends up happening? I begin to define myself as what? As a sinner. And after I define myself as a sinner for enough time, I give up hope that I can ever redeem myself. I give up hope that I could ever change. If one wants to save themselves from this, Yosim komachshavto rak ba'aseh. This is amazing. Says the Chazon Ish, how does the Jew deal with failure? How does the Jew deal with failure? Move on. Move on. Learn your lessons from your past and pledge to be better in your future. Do not live in the past. Do not dwell on your mistakes. Do not become obsessive with the averos you have committed. Because if you do that, the only thing that breeds, the only thing that creates is a sense of life despair. I'm a sinner. I'm nothing. I'm no good. When I make mistakes, says the Chazon Ish, the job of the Jew is learn the lesson, identify the weakness, move forward. Move forward. Raise yourself up. So the Chazon Ish says very strong wording over here. Sometimes you have to totally forget about the mistakes and the missteps of our past. V'taschil hakol mechadash ketinok shenolad. And sometimes you have to just let yourself begin all over again, like a baby who is being reborn. Now I know, very often, concepts like this come as a spiritual shock to us. Because sometimes, and I don't know where this comes from, but people have a very skewed sense of piety. And sometimes people think that, what does piety mean? The more you beat yourself up over your mistakes, the firmer you are. Essentially, like, the worse you feel about yourself, oh, you feel like a nothing? Wow, I'm so jealous. Right? I wish I felt like a nothing. You're so hailey gizoli. Feeling like a nothing is not piety. It's poor self-esteem. Right? That's not an aspiration. That's something we try to offer for one simple reason. If you feel like a nothing, then ultimately, again, you're going to become a nothing. If you feel like a nothing, there's no motivation to grow. There's no motivation to be more. Says the Chazon Ish, you make mistakes in life, you know what you do? You get up, you dust yourself off, you learn your lesson, and you move forward. Do not live in the past. Do not obsess over the past. Now again, I want to be clear. We know that part of tshuva is reflecting on your past. There's a way to reflect and there's a way to learn without becoming mired in it. The great challenge of life is in the aftermath of your mistakes. What do you do? Are you going to live it and relive it? You know, there are some people who replay their life mistakes over and over and over in their mind. And what happens as a result of that? It's one show, same show, over and over and over and over, and they never get back up. They want one life defeat, and they're down and out. Says the Chazon Ish, what do you have to do? Dust yourself off. Move forward. You'll do better next time. It says the Chazon Ish, that's the pshat in the Gemara. That's what it means when it says, "Hir hurei avera, kasha me'avera." It doesn't mean illicit thoughts are worse than the commission of an illicit act, but "Hir hurei avera" means people who obsessively think about their mistakes and the aftermath of the mistake, that's even worse than the commission of the avera itself. Why? Because here's the good news. If you commit an avera, you've only done one thing wrong. One thing wrong. If you live it and relive it and relive it and obsess and don't move forward, then you're committing the avera over and over and over again. Kashu hir hurei avera, hirei avera, kashu me avera. Obsessing in the thoughts and the aftermath of sin, living it over and over and over, and not finding the courage to move forward, is worse than the avera itself. So why does this matter for us? Watch this. Look at number 18. Number 18, I'm quoting to you from the Sefer Divrei Shmuel. Divrei Shmuel was written by Rav Shmuel Weinberg, who was the Slonim Rebbe. He lives from 1850 to 1916. And the Divrei Shmuel says something absolutely amazing. He says, why does the Malach tell the wife of Lot, Iris, not to look back? Why does he say, Al tabit acharecha? Listen to this. He's telling her, Al hanefilos shahayulach. He's saying to them, don't look back. Looking back, what does it mean when you look back at stone? What did stone represent for Iris, for Lot, for the Mishpacha? What did it represent? Their failures. It represented their failures. It represented a life that was not appropriate. It represented years and years and years of wasted time, of wasted potential. So what does the Malach say to them? Al tabet acharecha. Listen, I'm giving you the deal of a lifetime, a new beginning. But if you want to actualize your new beginning, there's one prerequisite, which is al tabet acharecha. You cannot look behind. You cannot dwell on your past failures. Al nefilos shayulach ki abet urei eishes lo tibita lachareha ma'ala l'sofa. So what happens? Now we begin to put this all together. So eishes lot looks back. Why does she look back? Because Iris was a woman who had an incredible amount of pain. What was her pain? She looks back. The Medrash says, why does she look back? She's looking for her daughters. Because effectively at that moment, what does she realize? What does she realize in that moment? She failed as a mother. She failed as a mother. That she was unable to raise a family that was steeped in anything meaningful. Vaharaya, the proof to this was that even when the angels come, and by the way, I just want to point out, the angels established their credentials, right? How do they establish their credentials? They made everyone in Stone blind. That's like a party trick or something, you know, meaning they established that they were legitimate angels. And despite that, Lot was unable, Iris was unable to convince their married daughters to come with them. What a profound failure as a mother. She looks back and she sees her failure. Maybe my daughters are coming after me. No, Iris, they're not coming after you. Because even as the fire and brimstone comes down, they still are not heeding your word. She looks back and she sees her failures as a mother. She looks back and she sees the sulfur, the salt, the fire, and she realizes her failure as a wife. Because she realizes in this moment that what? That she should have facilitated her husband's growth with the salt. Because he was right, she was wrong. The only reason she's alive now is why? Because of Avram Avinu. Because of the chesed of Avram Avinu. And so she looks back and she sees her home and she sees the salt piling up and she sees her failure as a wife. I failed to support my husband's growth. I failed to support my husband's dreams and aspirations. I failed to support my husband's upward momentum. I failed as a mother. I failed as a wife. So the Malach knows already that Eishes Lot is going to be tempted to go ahead and look back. So what does the Malach say to Eishes Lot? What does he say to Iris? Al tabit acharecha. Look, you're getting a new brand new beginning. You could start all over again. Yes, it's going to be painful. And yes, it's going to be difficult. And Nebuch, you will have lost two of your children. But at least some remnant of your family has been saved. You have the ability to start again. But what is the precondition for starting again? What is the precondition for taking advantage of the second, third, fifth, 27th chances in life? Atavit acharecha. You cannot live in the mistakes of your past. You cannot live and relive the mistakes of your past. You cannot focus on the nephilos, on the times that you fell down on the past. You can't look back, Iris. You can't look back, Lot. I'm giving you the gift of a brand new opportunity, but you have to detach yourself from the past failures. And now we understand why she turned into a pillar of salt. Salt is not a bad thing. Just the opposite. If you take a look at number 19, the pasuk tells us in Vayikra. Actually, spoke about this morning by the Perek Shirashir. V'chol karban minchascha b'melach timlach. What's talacha? Every single karban must be accompanied by salt. Salt is a good thing, right? Salt adds flavor. The Sefer Achinuch says, by the way, what's the primary identity of salt? What's salt's primary characteristic? It's a preservative. You see, what salt does is salt preserves things in their current state. Salt impedes or prevents change. The goal of salt is to preserve things in their present state. And now it all comes together. The Malach tells Lot and Iris, Al tabit acharecha, if you want a new beginning of light in life, you have to let go of the past failures. Don't look back. You can, as the Divrei Shmuel says, al nefil shahilecha, you can't look back at the past failures. Eishes Lot, Iris, cannot move past the failures of the past. And there were some pretty dramatic failures. As we said, failure as a mother, failure as a wife. She cannot move past those failures. So what does she turn into? She turns into salt. The ultimate preservative, symbolic of the fact that what? She was essentially sustained or frozen in her present state. Salt keeps things as they are. Eishes Lot exhibited an inability to recreate or to create a brand new future. She exhibited an inability to move past the past. And if you can't move past your past, then you're frozen in time. Then you become a pillar of salt. That is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is trying to teach us in this incredible and dramatic story. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us new beginnings. Every single day, but it's not even every single day. You know, the Pasuk in Tehillim says, Kol HaNeshama Tahalelka. Pasuk says in Tehillim, every soul gives praise to God. So the Zohar writes, Bechol Neshima U'Neshima Tahalelka. With every breath, you have to praise God. So Rabbi Yitzchak Abedichev writes, he says, what does he mean with every breath? He says something amazing. Every single time a person exhales, the neshama yearns to jump out of the body. The soul doesn't want to be here. The soul doesn't want to be in this world. The soul is the daughter of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The soul wants to go back to Shem. The soul wants to go back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Doesn't want to be here. Every single time I exhale, my neshama is yearning to jump out. And what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? What does he say? Stay put. Right, kneel. Whatever he says to the light of the soul. Stay where you are. Every single breath we take, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us a new beginning. The greatest gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us is the opportunity to start over as many times as we want. We often associate new beginnings with Elul, or Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, but in reality, you could start over as many times as you want. But there's one prerequisite for claiming your new beginning. What's the prerequisite? Al tabet acharecha. If you want a new chance at life, if you want a new beginning, you have to find the courage to stop looking in the life rear view mirror. You have to find the courage to stop obsessing over the failures. You have to find the courage to accept the fact that I have failed in the past. I can't change that. And therefore, if I can't change it, there's no point in reliving it. The only thing I could do is grow, pledge to be better, and take all of my efforts and plow them into a beautiful future. And in fact, if you go back to number one, with this we'll close. This is the very pasuk. Vahi kiotziam osam hachutza. So in the sermon, Hasidic literature, they read this pasuk in an incredibly dramatic way. And it was when they took them outside. What does this refer to? Vahi kiotziam hachutza means, the chutza means we live life in a box. We live life in a construct. And sometimes I say to myself, you know what? This is not working. The life that I am leading, the personality that I have constructed, it's just not working the way I need it to work. So here's the great gift. You could walk outside of yourself. Isn't it amazing? You could walk outside of yourself. If tonight you walk out to the beautiful, brisk air, and you decide, you know what? I want to be someone different. I don't mean different, like dramatically different. But I want to be someone better. I want to be someone better. I want to go hachutza. I want to go outside of the constructs that I have created for myself, because we all create our glass ceilings. We all create, I don't want that anymore. I want to go outside. I want to be self-transcendent. You can. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, fine. Vayomer, himaleit al nafshecha. Beautiful, run. Run towards something beautiful. Run towards your yet-to-be-claimed spirituality. Run towards your yet-to-be-discovered greatness. But if you want to go outside of yourself, you want to transcend yourself, you want to run to your yet-undiscovered greatness, there's only one prerequisite. Al tabet acharecha. Stop living in the past. Stop beating yourself up over past failures. Stop reviewing the mistakes and the missteps in life over and over and over. Va'al tamod b'chol akikar. Don't stand in place looking longingly at the past, about the past you messed up, the bad decisions you made, the things that went wrong. Va'al tamod b'kikar ha'ara, ha'ara himalait, pentisapeh. Run up the mountain. Run up the mountain. Because there is greatness to be claimed. There is beautiful accomplishment that awaits each of us. But only if we're willing to let go of the past. Only if we live lives of al tabet acharecha. We all have failures. And there's yitzhara to obsess over them, to relive them, to replay them, to ask ourselves, how did I make that decision? How did I do this? I can't believe this. And then we doubt ourselves, right? I made bad decisions in the past, so I doubt my ability to make good decisions, solid decisions in my present and my future. Well, if you live life like that, you have no future. Al tabet acharecha va'al ta'amod b'chol akikar ha'hara himalit. If we're willing to let go of the past, then there is no telling what kind of beautiful future awaits us all. All right, we'll stop over here.